Okay, we'll call to order the meeting of the House Committee on Judiciary, Civil Law. Welcome everybody here today. Kind of the calm, not before, but between the storms here with some hearings again on Senate bills now. Committee, I think we probably should have made fairly short work of the agenda today, but it may be a faint hope. Let's start though with Senate Bill 662, open a public hearing on that and invite up Senator Brown while counsel gives us the background.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 662, as amended, would allow a judge in a dissolution proceeding to waive the 90-day waiting period, which is required before a decree can be granted on the basis that the parties have entered into a stipulated judgment regarding custody, parenting time, and child support. You notice that property is left out of that list. It clarifies that the court's authority to order a temporary restraining order related to the assets of the parties relates to property held jointly as well as individually. It authorizes the courts to order custodial investigations in certain types of domestic relations proceedings. These are also known as custody studies in some counties. It clarifies that the court can authorize interviews of third parties and have access to certain mental health records in the course of those investigations. And it clarifies the procedure on converting a separation decree into a dissolution decree. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Does anybody else have, I don't have a staff measure summary. Do you? Do we all have staff measure summaries on this bill or not?
Which bill is it?
662.
662.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's my fault, and let me get those for you.
Thank you. You want to make copies off of that? Okay. While he's doing that, we'll welcome Senator Brown and Ms. Dentinger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Kate Brown, State Senator, Senate District 7. I introduced this bill at the request of Conrad Hedderly, who's the editor of the Family Law Section's newsletter, and I believe Aaron did a great job explaining the bill. It received no opposition in the House. It's been supported by the Family Law Section of the Oregon State Bar, and the Oregon Men's Association has no opposition to it. So thank you very much for your time and energy, and appreciate your support.
Thank you for that. Statement for the record, Ms. Dentinger.
For the record, my name is Tammy Dentinger. I am a attorney in private practice here in Salem with the law firm of Garrett Heeman, Robertson, Paulus, James, and Comstock. I practice almost exclusively in the area of family law. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Family Law Section, and we support this bill. As it stands now, there are a number of different deadlines that our clients must understand and be able to soak in a divorce decree. The 90-day waiting period starts from the day that the other party is served or accepts service. From that time, there's 90 days before a final judgment can be entered, regardless of whether it's stipulated to or not, unless you can come up with some extreme financial reason or some hardship reason for the court to waive that requirement. By having a 90-day waiting period there when the parties have stipulated the custody and visitation and support issues, what you really do are you force the parties to enter into temporary motions and temporary orders to kind of set the rules for support, visitation, and custody in the interim in that 90-day period. Without a temporary order, without a final judgment, the Department of Human Resources cannot collect the support obligation, you can't enforce the support obligation, you can't support the custody or visitation parenting time provisions of the agreement. This would get rid of that provision and will prevent clients from having to go to the added expense of going through the temporary process to get a temporary order. It also would make this situation a lot clearer and a lot more straightforward for clients who are represented as well as pro se litigants. Family Law Section supports this bill.
Mr. Chair, I did want to add, in your packets, you should have two letters from Bill Vallant, who's an attorney in Portland. He wrote the original letter to Ken Baker, and I didn't receive it until it was like I didn't want to draft another bill, so we simply amended this particular bill to address his concerns. Aaron, explain them. They're mostly technical in nature and grammatical.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the Family Law Section supports all the amendments as well.
The amendments that are already incorporated in the engrossed
That's
version.
Correct.
There's no new amendments. Okay.
No amendments.
All right, any questions for either Ms. Dentinger or Senator Brown? Representative Wibblewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering why in this bill you only addressed the stipulated judgment for custody, et cetera, and didn't talk about property settlement agreements, because you can't have a final judgment until the property is taken care of.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erlau, my understanding was we intended to address the issues regarding custody support so that they didn't have to be a pending ID order, so when those issues have been addressed, the parties didn't need to wait for
the 90-day period.
Sure.
Well, actually, I suppose different jurisdictions treat this differently, but I've never had any problem having the 90 days waive if you come before the court already agreeing with property settlement, other issues. You do have a problem in other jurisdictions?
Can I answer, Secretary Representative Berlau? My understanding is from talking to other family law practitioners is there are some counties that are, it's very difficult to get a waiver, and it also is the additional cost. I think it's, the system is such that a pro se litigant is going to have a hard time figuring out how to get a waiver, number one, and number two, those people who are represented are going to have to go to the added expense of paying me or somebody else to do that for them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rubelaw, both Tammy and I spoke at a family law conference here in Salem, and when we raised this issue with the family law attorneys that were there, there were several nodding heads that folks are having trouble with judges waiving the 90-day period. I didn't think it was an issue. I never had a problem, but other folks have had problems.
We would just come from more accommodating judicial districts.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lowe.
I can confirm that there are certain counties in this state where it's tough to get one of those.
That is tough.
I won't tell you which one.
Does the county seat begin with O?
Yeah.
Representative Warbelow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, but I still don't think you answered my question. Is it talks about submitting an affidavit saying that a stipulated judgment has been signed that provides for all those specific items. Those items do not include a property settlement agreement, yet it seems to me the way this is written that you could have a judgment just so the things specified are taken care of, and who cares about the property settlement agreement or whatever, however the property is going to be distributed. You can't leave it hanging out there, and that's my concern, the way this is written.
Representative Urbala, I don't know if I'm understanding your concern. Is your concern that the property portions of the judgment or the agreement wouldn't become effective for 90 days? But or are you talking about those litigants who just have a property-only divorce and leaving those guys hanging?
No.
Okay.
I'm talking about any divorce that has property in it. You have to address the property, whether by agreement or otherwise,
right.
Okay? This bill, what it does is waive the 90-day period. If you have an affidavit, you know, of emergency or necessity, then it goes on to show that an affidavit stating that a judgment has been signed about those certain issues is adequate grounds of necessity for immediate action. But it doesn't speak to what's in that stipulated judgment except custody, parenting, child support, spousal support. Are you just assuming that the people have taken care of their property needs?
Well, let me ask if that's not...
Mr. Chair, I think I understand what Representative Urbelow
right, you've got to wrap
asking,
up the whole thing.
And I don't know the answer to that question other than I thought that was to be not an exclusive list, but a list that would include other things as well.
Well, and I was going to ask if that isn't... And again, I don't do domestic relations, but is that addressed on lines 14 and 15... Well, that sentence that concludes on lines 14 and 15 where it authorizes the court to enter judgment dissolving the marriage, and wouldn't the judgment dissolving the marriage incorporate the property distribution?
I would hope so, but it also would have to be a property distribution that was agreed to, otherwise you're going to have a trial on it or a hearing on it. So that's why I'm saying maybe there's just a lot of assumptions in here that it's taken care of.
Chair Shelley, Representative Overlau, my understanding of the way this is worded is that in the way that the family law section is reading it, is that if you have stipulated to everything, then you can get the judgment can be entered, but you can only get it if there's a custody, visitation, or support issue. If it's a property-only case, you have to wait your 90 days, but if it's property plus something else, then you can get out of the 90-day waiting period.
Oh, okay. And maybe the confusion is because you can get a property-only 90-day waiver right now. You know, if you come with a property settlement agreement between the parties submitted to the court.
The family law, especially Representative Overall, the family law section would be supportive of getting rid of that 90-day waiting period in its entirety. But specifically when there's custody and visitation and support issues, it just saves a lot of time and money as far as not needing to use the temporary support process.
Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give us just a little background? You talk about a parent of a child born out of wedlock. Could you just give us a little background about children born out of wedlock and how this issue is addressed currently, and how this language on page 2C.
On what page?
Page 3, line 15. And how the issue of children born out of wedlock, how are they handled today, currently, and then how will this make a change?
Sure, Shadowy Representative Edwards. What the bill also does is it deals with a lot of unanswered questions within the family law practice. Senator Brown's been kind enough to let us use this bill to answer a lot of our questions, custody or visitation case. In a divorce, there's a statute that specifically allows the court to appoint an expert, a PhD, MSW, someone with some expertise to do an independent investigation and make a recommendation to the court as to who should have custody, what the appropriate parenting time is. It was unanswered for paternity cases and when children were born out of wedlock. There was no specific authorization of the court. Courts in Marion County, I know, have just assumed that they have the power to do that. This just makes it very clear that whenever there's a contested custody or visitation case, the court has the authority to appoint an expert to do an independent investigation and make a recommendation. It was just a hole that needed to be filled.
Thank you.
Representative Warbaugh, you had one.
I did have one more question on page 3, lines 26 to 28, where it says the court may require other persons to be interviewed and so forth. Other persons may be non-parties. And I'm just wondering where the court's authority are. Will you have the parties issuing subpoenas? I mean, how do you expect to get people in that are not under the court's jurisdiction?
Chair Shadowy, Representative Urgelau, that could also mean the children of the parties. It could be the party's significant others. It could be their grandparents. It could be people that arguably are under the direction and control of one of the parties. And I guess how I would interpret it, what I had to do as a practitioner, is I would have a deposition and I would ask that party the questions that the custody evaluator wanted to know, and then provide the custody evaluator with a copy of the transcript.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Urgelau, I think the purpose of that is to make sure that the court has the ability to include all the parties involved with the family necessary in the evaluation.
All right. Thank you very much. If you just want to step back for a minute, I have one more witness signed up, Michael Bouchard. Bouchard? Yeah, there you
go. Thank you, Chairperson Shirley and members of the committee. My name is Michael Andrew Bouchard. I live here in Salem, Oregon. My address is 1115 Madison Street, Northeast, Salem, Oregon, 97303. I wish to address the fact of what was brought up about the children born out of wedlock. I do have a son born out of wedlock, and even though trying to affect mediated, I guess you could say, counseling with my ex-significant other, she chose instead to enact or begin an action against me for support, custody, and visitation. I'm here with all but a nightmarish story. I haven't seen my son in 3 months because even though the 90-day issue is both basically for a lot of the things of married couples, I have property still in her house. I do not have any custody or visitation lined out, and it's become a long, drawn-out issue. I do support this bill, however. I think it should be strong. I think it should be stronger, worded stronger for the unmarried couples out here. Because regardless of the fact that we did not tie the knot or get married, we still have an issue, same as married couples do. I do wholeheartedly support the provision about having other people brought into the process. However, I also think that it should incorporate subpoenas of parties that have knowledge of the, I guess you could say, the character, and where were the words there? Basically about the character of the other party. My ex-significant other has had public displays of anger and rage becoming almost totally uncontrollable, swearing, etc. And I think that those people should be brought into the process to help shed light upon the character. As well as, she fled from across the country. She is in a former divorce case, and that gentleman has been denied his access to his children because she fled so far away from him. That should be brought into the process. These are things that, I mean, they're of a personal nature that I probably shouldn't delve into, but the point is that some of us unmarried couples out here, we have our problems too, and there is not much provision. The restraining order, which I will probably address this committee at another time, and I have talked to several of the members of this committee about, I was actually restrained from seeing my son and having any contact to try to negotiate or communicate with my ex-significant other. I could not actually get into the courtroom in fast enough because there was a 21-day waiting period. And so I don't know if that is not actually addressed here. However, since that restraining order was dismissed prior to the hearing, again, I'm left hanging. I am a computer tech. I'm going to school. She has my computer. What do I get to use? And again, it comes down to visitation. So I am not against this bill at all. I'm all for it, but I think it should be more strongly worded for the unmarried children and those that are born out of wedlock as well.
Okay.
But at this time, I am free to answer any questions to the committee or either chair you, sir, have.
Thank you, Mr. Bouchard. All right. Actually, Senator and Tammy, if I can have you back up for one more question on page 3, I want to follow up on that just so we get it in the record. And it is the new language on lines 25 through 28, the provision for the court requiring other persons to be interviewed. What do the courts have jurisdiction authority to require people who are not parties, and what's the process for that? Just be under subpoena power?
Chair Shelley, members of the committee, the court, without a subpoena or cannot force other people to appear, to participate. I read this as to just give the custody evaluator authority to try to talk to those people or to consider information from other people other than the two parties and the children. They might be able to bring in significant others or family members who might have witnessed, you know, outbursts of anger or other sorts of things. And then the attorneys of the parties or the parties themselves could subpoena people who aren't as cooperative to a deposition and get the information that way. I don't think the court can force somebody to talk to a custody evaluator.
I guess that's the interesting question. What does require apply to the evaluator, or does require apply to the person to be interviewed? That is, does the court instruct the evaluator to talk to other people, or is this a provision for the court requiring other people to talk to the evaluator?
Mr. Chair, my thought was that it would apply to the court itself. And I guess the reason why I thought it was necessary, I have practiced in this area, thankfully, for a period of time. But it was my sense that, from practical purposes, evaluators, at least in Multnomah County, just did it, just talked to third parties, and it wasn't an issue. And I assume in some cases it does, and this would give the court a little oomph to kind of encourage folks to be involved.
Yeah, I'm Representative Werbelow.
We do have it on the record now. My concern with the language, it looks like the court can require persons other than parties to be interviewed. And it's not quite that simple. They can't force somebody. And I think the language is a little misleading, but you've explained it. I don't know if it's sufficient.
I'll kind of defer to the Senator and Ms. Dentinger. We've got possession of it, and we can clean this up if you think it needs to be cleaned up. If you're satisfied with it as is, I'm happy to move it. I don't think anyone's got a problem with it.
Mr. Chair, I think the certified smart person thinks it's okay, so let's move it.
All right. Well,
besides, it'll give us something to do next session.
Yes.
No problem.
I can't wait for the hearing to come back and clean up the, Representative Werbelow.
I have another question. Page 4. This converting a separation to dissolution. Again, we can already do that, so why all this new language?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erbelow, this is just clarifying language, simplifying the process.
We've been doing this for years, so I think everybody understood how to do it, so I just curious.
Chair Shelley, Representative Erbelow, I know that the first one I did, I had no idea how to do it, and the statute wasn't very guiding as far as what you needed to file and how it needed to be done. We all knew it could be done. This just tells us how you do it.
Okay. All right. Is there anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 662? If not, I'll close the public hearing. All right. And that's all we'll do for this bill for today. We'll bring it back. Let's go ahead with a public hearing on Senate Bill 784. And with that, Senator Brown, you're here on that too, aren't you? Yeah, okay, please.
Thank you.
Okay, Tammy, that's your seat.
Tammy's coming up too.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Kate Brown, represent Senate District 7. I introduced Senate Bill 784 at the request of a constituent, Mark Kramer. Mark does family law, including grandparents and psychological parents' rights, and he's been doing it for over 10 years. The bill does one simple thing, and I believe you do have a letter from Mark in your packets. It allows but does not require a court to award attorney's fees and grandparent visitation actions under ORS 109.121. An attorney fee and cost provision is available in virtually all the other family law proceedings, including dissolution, separations, child and spousal support, and modifications of these actions. And then last session, we added a provision for attorney's fees and costs in psychological parent actions under ORS 109.119. I'd be happy to answer any questions. The bill simply conforms grandparent visitation to other procedures in family law.
Was that a preparation for a question?
You want
okay, to? Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Brown, I introduced a bill earlier that I couldn't make work for love nor money. I tried really hard to define how grandparent visitation would be charged in terms of time so that it didn't disadvantage one parent or another particularly the non-custodial parent, from their parenting time, which may be more important that the child have contact with their parent. And as we lay out the legislative history of this bill, I just thought that a discussion ought to be had about is it your contemplation within this bill that a charge of time to grandparents, a grandparent's assessment of time should be related, should be limited somehow, or should be charged against the patrilineal line or matrilineal. You want to go there?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, I don't want to go there, but what I do think by adding an attorney's fees provision is that it helps deter meritless actions, and I hope it encourages those with merit. So, in a sort of subtle way, it might answer your question. Ms. Dettinger may want to respond.
Chair Sotomayor, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Dettinger. I'm a lawyer in private practice here in Salem with the law firm of Garrett Heeman, Robertson, Paulus, James, and Comstock. I practice almost entirely in the family law section, in the family law area. I'm also appearing on behalf of the family law section of the Oregon State Bar. Chair Shirley, Representative Lowe, in answer to your question, I know that we've had some conversations with your office about the bill that you're speaking of. This bill just simply deals with the attorney fee award, and it allows the court to reward or basically punish people for their actions in dealing with each other. If grandparents are being unreasonable in their request for time and are using this statute to penalize a custodial parent or to financially blackmail a custodial parent, the court could take appropriate action. If a custodial parent is using the statute or trying to prohibit the grandparents from having any contact with the child, the court can make the appropriate assessment of costs based upon their actions. It's the one area of family law that doesn't have an attorney fee provision, and it's kind of glaringly missing. All the other, you know.
Follow-up question.
Sure.
Thank you, Ms. Dettinger. I bet you can't give your credentials five times fast.
second only to Ronell. Yeah,
right. She just reports it out. Okay, so is there anything in this bill that would contemplate the court assessing attorney's fees against a cooperative parent in the event of that the other parent is denying grandparents?
Chair Shadley, Representative Lowe, all I can say is that it doesn't specifically say that. It leaves the attorney fee award to the discretion of the court. And in my experience as a family law practitioner, one of the only reasons, and this is in a divorce case, and I'll give you the second reason they award attorney's fees in a divorce case, but the only reason I've seen courts award attorney's fees in these sorts of cases is if one party has unreasonably made the process more difficult and more expensive for the other party. I don't contemplate this affecting the rights of visitation or how the court determines what visitation is going to be, but it doesn't specifically address the reasons the court can award attorney's fees. It's at the discretion of the court.
Okay. Any other questions? Any other witnesses on Senate Bill 74? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving both of these bills a hearing.
Yeah, you bet. We'll go to work session right now on this one, get that taken care of. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 784 and open a work session on Senate Bill 784.
Mr. Chairman, I move 784 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Lowe moves Senate Bill 784 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Bassler? Aye.
Representative
Bassler?
Aye.
Representative
Berbelow? Yes.
Representative
Walker?
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Whip?
Aye.
Chair
Shirley? Aye. Senate Bill 74 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have a volunteer to carry it? Okay. Representative Wells. All right. Thank you very much.
That would be because you're a grandpa.
Okay, let's go back to the top of the agenda and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 792. Mr. Gardner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Gardner. I'm special counsel to the Attorney General Hardy Myers, and I'm here today to testify in favor of Senate Bill 792. Cigarette smoking presents a serious public health concern for Oregon and its citizens. In addition, cigarette smoking also presents serious financial concerns for our state. Oregon and its citizens pay millions of dollars each year in medical costs to treat smoking-related illnesses. In the past months, the Attorney General has negotiated and settled Oregon's legal claims against the major national tobacco manufacturers. In consummation of that settlement, Oregon, together with 45 other states and five territories in the District of Columbia, have entered into a master settlement agreement with those national tobacco manufacturers. The master settlement agreement contains economic provisions that obligate the participating manufacturers to pay Oregon a portion of the state's costs associated with the tobacco company's misrepresentations and distributions of cigarettes in Oregon. In addition, the participating manufacturers have agreed to certain non-economic terms that restrict their advertising and marketing practices and control their corporate behavior. Although the MSA, Master Settlement Agreement, made great strides in assuring the accountability of the tobacco manufacturers, if Oregon is to ensure the long-term public health and financial gains of the Master Settlement Agreement, it is critical that all manufacturers of cigarettes marketed in our state be made accountable for the potential costs associated with their Oregon cigarette sales. Except for a few minor procedural changes, Senate Bill 792 is identical to the model statute provided in Exhibit T of the Master Settlement Agreement. The goal of Senate Bill 792 is to provide assurance that all companies that sell cigarettes in Oregon, including those companies that have not entered into the Master Settlement Agreement, are financially capable of fulfilling their economic obligations, if any, to Oregon and its citizens. In addition, passage of Senate Bill 792 will protect the state's annual payments from a potential dramatic non-participating manufacturer's adjustment. This statute was the subject of extensive and difficult negotiations, including discussions on whether the statute would survive legal challenges. The statute was reviewed by a number of antitrust and constitutional law experts who opined that this statute would survive legal challenge. Section 1 states the findings and purposes of the Act. It outlines the findings that cigarette smoking presents serious financial concerns to the state and that these costs should be borne by tobacco manufacturers, including those who have not signed the Master Settlement Agreement. Section 2 of Senate Bill 792 sets forth the definitions. Many of the bill's definitions incorporate by reference the definitions in the Master Settlement Agreement. This was done to avoid any confusion between the two documents and to prevent this legislation from being overly lengthy. I've provided one copy of the entire Master Settlement Agreement to the Judiciary Committee. I did that on the Senate side, and I assume that Council will have access to that on the House side. In addition, the master settlement agreement is a public document approved by the Multnomah County Circuit Court in the case of the State of Oregon versus the American Tobacco Company et al. And further, a complete copy of the master settlement agreement can be found at www.nag.org on the Internet. Section 3 requires that all tobacco manufacturers do one of two things: participate in the master settlement agreement or establish an escrow account and place dollars into that account at a stated rate per unit sold in this state. The rates are calculated to be equivalent to the rates paid by the participating manufacturers pursuant to the master settlement agreement. The changes in rates also mirror the changes in the master settlement agreement annual payments on a per unit basis. The manufacturer who placed funds in escrow is entitled to withdraw interest or other earnings from the account as they are earned. The principal deposited in escrow can be released from escrow only to pay a judgment or settlement on any claim brought by the state or a party located or residing in Oregon, or if the manufacturer establishes that the amount it would have paid the state had it participated in the master settlement agreement is less than the amount the manufacturer is required to place in escrow, then the manufacturer is allowed to withdraw the excess from escrow, or if the funds have remained in escrow for a period of 25 years from the date of the payment. Section 3 also provides for monitoring by the Oregon Department of Revenue, enforcement by the Attorney General, and civil penalties for violations of the Act's requirements. It is important to note that Oregon is not required to pass this statute. The Master Settlement Agreement and the Consent Decree will remain in force and effect regardless of the legislative action on this bill. However, passage of this statute will help protect the public health in Oregon and will protect the state settlement payment from a possible draconian and dramatic reduction. In explanation, the Master Settlement Agreement provides for an adjustment to state payments if the disadvantages experienced as a result of the Master Settlement Agreement are a significant factor contributing to the participating manufacturer's loss of market share, in effect, the non-participating manufacturer's adjustment, found on page 58 at section 9D of the Master Settlement Agreement. To illustrate how this adjustment might work, consider the following example. In 2003, the original participating manufacturer's market share was reduced from 97.5% in 1997 to 93.5%. Secondly, that the original participating manufacturer shipped fewer cigarettes into the United States and Puerto Rico in 2003 than they shipped in 1997. The Master Settlement Agreement was a significant factor contributing to the market share loss. All states except Oregon, New York, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island adopt a non-participating tobacco manufacturer's legislation, and the year for which the payments are being calculated is 2004. The market share loss is 4%. However, for the analysis, you only count market share loss beyond the first 2%. Hence, the market share loss is 2%. The Master Settlement Agreement requires the market share loss beyond 2% to be multiplied by 3. Thus, the adjustment to the payment to the states is a 6% reduction. The annual payment in 2004 is $7.4 billion. 6% of this amount is $420,240,000. This amount is divided among the states that didn't pass the non-participating manufacturer legislation based upon their relative allocation under the MSA. The reductions are outlined in the following chart. If you go down and look at Oregon, the adjustment, which is the fourth column over under Oregon, shows $23,670,242. That's the amount of loss that we would have in our payment in that year alone. In the following example, Oregon would lose $23,670,242 by not passing the non-participating manufacturer statute in 2004 alone. This adjustment is calculated each year. If the original participating manufacturers continued to lose market share and the market share in 2005 remained at 93.5%, these four states would continue to experience a similar non-participating manufacturer adjustment. As this illustration demonstrates, the consequences of not enacting Senate Bill 792 can be dire. The Attorney Generals who negotiated this agreement worked diligently to provide the states with a safe haven from the dramatic effects of a non-participating manufacturer adjustment. Enactment of this statute is that safe haven. Indeed, even if a court were to find the statute unconstitutional, the maximum adjustment Oregon would have to bear is 65% of the payment in any particular year if the legislature enacts the statute. So you get, in essence, an insurance policy, even if the statute gets struck down by the court, as it relates to 35% of the payments that are due to the state. Without passage of the statute, the maximum non-participating manufacturer adjustment could be 100% of the payment. I strongly recommend that the legislature pass this important public health legislation, and I ask the committee to recommend that Senate Bill 792 be sent to the full House with a due pass recommendation. And I apologize for the word Senate there. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. Do we have to understand this bill in order to pass it?
Chairman Shetterly, I guess the answer to that is probably no, but I will do everything in my power to make sure that you do understand it, and you should understand it before you pass.
I understand the big picture consequences. That's pretty clear. Representative Werbelow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you're further ahead than I am then, because I must be missing something. But the way I read this bill is that we are saying to people who are not parties to the master settlement agreement that they have to put money, they did not enter into that agreement, that they have to put money in escrow because of maybe some future liability that is even established. There's been no trial finding them liable. And I just don't know how you can come off doing that. I have some real problems with that. So am I missing something?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Uberlau, I think the state has the power to require someone to put money into escrow. Now, the state is not taking the money. Okay, in essence, they're requiring, like, you know, a business have a certain capitalization to take care of its potential liabilities. This is not money that is collected by the state. This is not money that goes to the state. This is money that is merely set aside for the purposes of satisfying any kind of potential liability for a very dangerous product.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you are denying the use of that money to them, so there is some consequences. We may not be using it, but when they put it in escrow, that means they don't have the use. And I see it the same thing as telling me personally, well, put this money in escrow because what you do is dangerous out there, and sometime the state might sue you and win, and then that money will be available to us. That seems a very iffy proposition to me. I mean, I'd love to go out and get those cigarette companies, but somehow we seem to be doing it on a very tenuous basis, in my mind.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Uberlau, I guess all I can say to you is a couple of points. First of all, that this has been looked at by constitutional law, antitrust experts, and they've said that the state has the authority to do this, that it is constitutional and will be upheld. Secondly, the Master Settlement Agreement does a lot of things to kind of change the playing field in terms of requiring the people that sign on to it to, in essence, you know, restrict themselves as far as their marketing and other activities. And I think it's important to note that no company is required to put this money into escrow. They can sign the Master Settlement Agreement and avoid that responsibility or obligation.
Kind of coercion.
Let me ask, you're the only witness signed up to testify on this bill today. I'll ask one before we close if anybody else is here to speak in opposition to the bill. How about in the Senate? I see the Senate vote was unanimous in committee. Did anyone testify against? And it was voted 27-1 on the floor. Did anyone testify against this in committee?
Chairman Shetterly, the answer is no. There was no testimony in opposition to the bill, and Senator Shields voted against the bill, but I don't know why he cast that vote. Otherwise, it was unanimous.
Any other questions? Representative Edwards.
Just to clarify for the record, you're saying it's constitutional. You're talking about the state or the U.S. Constitution?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, both.
Thank you.
Based on the opinion of yeah.
Correct. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, and that's pursuant to an analysis that was done by Deputy Attorney General Schuman. I'm not the constitutional law expert in our office, so it's not my opinion.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was Mr. Schumann's opinion in writing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Uberlau, no.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lowe.
To follow up on the Chairman's comment about is it necessary to understand this bill in order to pass it out, I have a question in that vein. Forgive me. Is there anything in this bill that would preclude the use of these funds in some sort of a flexible way? The various schemes have been proposed by the executive office and other people to use some of the money for school funding or some other sources. Is there anything at all in this bill that would preclude that kind of flexibility?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, the funds in question are monies that are paid by non-participating manufacturers into an escrow account.
No, I mean in the tobacco settlement money in general. There's nothing in here that's going to hurt that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lowe, the answer is no. There's nothing in the bill.
Just wanted it on the record.
So in simplest terms, then, this bill basically creates an alternative process for companies that for one reason or another, wish not to participate in the master settlement agreement.
Mr. Chairman, that is exactly correct. But they have the option of signing the master settlement agreement, and right now there's 99.8% of the market in the United States are in the tobacco manufacturing business are signatories to the master settlement agreement. If I might add one last comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. This statute in the present form was basically negotiated with the tobacco manufacturers. Under the MSA, the statute that's passed by the state of Oregon or any other state has to be a qualifying statute. And it's qualifying in two ways. One, if both sides say it's qualifying, or if there's an independent auditor that looks at the statute after it's been passed and determines that it qualifies. We negotiated right down to the commas and the parentheses in order to get the original participating manufacturers to sign off on the statute as a qualifying statute. So if there are amendments to the bill, the issue of whether or not it is qualifying and effective are in question.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Yes.
One last technical question. How much money do you anticipate being put in escrow?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, that will change from year to year. I think the present amount would be equivalent to about 18 and a half cents per pack of cigarettes would be placed in escrow, which reflects about what the increase has been for the major tobacco manufacturers that have raised their prices in the state of Oregon because of restrictions in the settlement.
Last question. Yes, how many companies entered into the MSA and how many are out?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Edwards, there were initially four companies that signed on as original participating manufacturers. Since that time, there have been probably, I'm going to say somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 that have signed on, and presently they represent 99.8% of the market share in the United States.
Okay, anything further then on Senate Bill 792? If not, I'll close the public hearing and open the work session. Senate Bill 792. Representative Williams.
I move Senate Bill 792 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 792 to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Representative Orlow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to vote no against this with some reservations. Hopefully I'll be able to have a conversation with Mr. Schumann. But I'd love to see the tobacco manufacturers pay through their teeth for all the harm they've caused. However, I just have real questions about if you can force somebody to do this when they have the option not to enter into the agreement, and they took that option. There's not been a finding of liability in the court, and that we can say you cannot use your money, and it's going to be put in this account for a period of time. If Mr. Schumann can convince me it's okay after talking to him, I'll vote yes for it. But right now, I can't vote yes.
All right. Please call the roll.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Aye.
Representative Wall?
Aye.
Representative Verbal Law?
No.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wells?
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Excuse? Aye. Senate Bill 792 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer? Okay, I'll carry it.
We'll now open a public hearing on Senate Bill 387. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 387 allows a juvenile court to proceed with a termination of parental rights case even though the parents or parent have appealed the juvenile court's finding of jurisdiction to the Court of Appeals. Mr. Chairman?
Thank you, Council. We have Melinda Bruce and Kathy...
Ledesma.
Ledesma, that's Kathy. And the only other witness we have signed up is Tim Travis. So, Tim, why don't you come up and we'll just have you all on the panel, since you all appear to be testifying in support.
Thank you.
We'll start with you, Linda.
Vice Chair Williams, members of the committee, I'm Melinda Bruce. I'm an assistant attorney general in the family law section of the Department of Justice, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 387. This bill proposes to amend ORS 419B200 subsection 6, which permits the juvenile court in certain circumstances to enter continuing orders in juvenile cases even though an appeal of an earlier order of the juvenile court is pending. For quite some time, the Department of Justice and others have interpreted these provisions to permit the juvenile court to hear a termination of parental rights case even though an appeal of a jurisdictional or dispositional order was pending in the Court of Appeals or Oregon Supreme Court. It was our belief that no party was prejudiced by this procedure because the child would remain in foster care during the pendency of an appeal anyway. The interpretation allowed these cases to move more quickly through the system to permit a child to be freed for adoption earlier should the pending appeal be upheld and termination of parental rights ordered. And if the jurisdictional or dispositional order was overturned on appeal, the termination of parental rights order would, of course, be a nullity because the jurisdictional or dispositional order would be a factual predicate for the termination. In essence, this interpretation put the risk of going forward with a termination of parental rights case on the petitioner, and petitioner is almost always the State Office for Services to Children and Families, who would evaluate the case carefully before going ahead in such circumstances. And in any event, the juvenile court would always have the discretion to decline to go ahead with a termination of parental rights case if it felt that was not prudent under the circumstances. Last April, in a case pending before it, the Court of Appeals entered an order interpreting 419A200 subsection 6 in a different way than the Oregon Department of Justice had been interpreting it up until then. I've attached a copy of that order to my testimony, but in essence what the Court of Appeals said was that that statute does not give the juvenile court jurisdiction to go ahead with the termination of parental rights case when an appeal of an order involving the same or similar facts was pending. This is problematic because almost all termination of parental rights cases will involve some or all of the same facts that had been adjudicated earlier in the juvenile court. So it's going to be very difficult to find those cases that would not fit within the Court of Appeals assessment. This means that in some cases, children will have to wait a year or more longer than they otherwise would have to wait if a termination of parental rights case went ahead. The amendments we have proposed to ORS 419A206 would fix this problem. They would expressly permit the juvenile court to go ahead with a termination of parental rights case when an appeal of an earlier order was pending. We believe that this makes sense in terms of children's time frames. It will assist the state to meet its obligations under ASFA to move these cases increasingly more quickly through the system. I would take any questions at this point.
Representative Werbelow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the packet we received a proposed amendment which actually consolidates. Is this from you all?
Yes, I'm sorry. Chair Shatterly, Representative Uberlau, following the hearing in the Senate, there was some sense that this bill should clarify exactly what happened, if the bill passes, exactly what would happen in the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court if a termination of parental rights order was entered. And what we concluded was that we should specify that any appeal from the termination order would then be consolidated with the ongoing appeal and advanced on the court's calendar like a termination case, which means that it's expedited.
Okay. Who's next? Well, I'm sorry, Representative Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm confused. So I need some help, because on the one hand, you say you want to get this through the process so the kids can get adopted quicker, but on the other hand, you say that they're going to remain in foster care during the pendency of the appeal. So how does that all work?
Chair Shatterly, Representative Walker, my point there is that in terms of analyzing whether this bill would prejudice any party's rights, that is, the parents' rights, let's say, this bill would not change the status quo with respect to what happens to a child during the pendency of an appeal or during the pendency of a termination of parental rights case. A child will remain in foster care pending that appeal, whether or not we have this bill. It's our belief that children will remain in foster care longer if we don't have this bill, because the children will be in foster care as the appellate process spins its way out. Following that process, assuming that the order appealed is affirmed, we then need to start from scratch in terms of getting a trial date for the termination of parental rights case, trying the case, and then a possible appeal of that termination order. So
let me, if I understand then, the two things will be going at the same time. The appeal will proceed, and then you'll continue with your proceedings to terminate parental rights, but the child stays with foster care.
It stays with foster parents.
Okay. I'm okay
correct.
With that.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What happens in the case where you have both proceedings running at the simultaneously and the appeal, it's reversed upon appeal? Isn't that in some cases going to require going back to the trial court, not just on the first case, but possibly on the second case if that decision came down prior to the appeal coming down?
Chair Shatterly, Representative Witt, that certainly is a possibility. In that case, what's going to happen, depending on the order that was on appeal, it may moot out the termination case. For example, if the appeal was of a jurisdictional order, the order that established juvenile court jurisdiction, and that order is overturned on appeal, then the termination of parental rights case is negated because jurisdiction is a factual predicate for termination of parental rights. those, I think it's important to underscore that this bill does not require either the agency or the juvenile court to go ahead with a termination of parental rights case. And I think in those cases where there is a significant question about the validity of the order that's on appeal, that neither the agency nor the juvenile court is going to go ahead with a termination of parental rights case simply because of the possibility that you raise. In my experience, those cases are few and far between. This bill really is aimed at those cases where the appeal is of somewhat dubious merit and is delaying the overall progress of the case.
Representative Wells.
Yeah, thank you. My question is on the same line. We have everything moving down the track. Now, can you move to final termination while that appeal is there? And if that would happen, then what would be the process?
Chair Shatterly, Representative Wells, that's the case now under the Court of Appeals interpretation of the statute that we seek to amend. What the Court of Appeals has said is that no, you cannot go forward with a termination of parental rights case while that appeal is pending. You must wait for the appeal to be concluded and have a final decision. Under this bill, a court could go ahead and try a termination of parental rights case even though there was an appeal of some prior order in the case pending in the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court.
I guess, Mr. Chair, my question is, can they, I understand we were moving down the track together, but can you get a final termination of parental rights while that appeal is out there? Under this bill?
Chair Shatterly, Representative Wells, under this bill, you could have an order entered. It would not be effective until the conclusion of the appellate process.
That was my question, because I understood we were moving along together and you can get the process going and that's what speeds it up, but basically you can't get the final termination still until the appeal is satisfied.
And how we see this happening would be you'd have the termination order. I'm certain that that order would be appealed. It would be rolled into the appeal of the jurisdictional or dispositional order, and at the conclusion of that appeal, if all orders were affirmed, then the termination of parental rights order would be effective, and the child could then move toward adoptive placement.
Representative Backlund has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Anybody could answer this question, anyone up here at all. Is it very unusual or is it common for action to move ahead when there's an appeal pending? And just generally?
In most cases, that doesn't happen.
Chair Shatterly, Representative Backlund, one of the reasons that this legislation, I'm Timothy Travis with the Oregon Judicial Department, personally I have tried termination of parental rights cases. The law firm I work for is the only law firm in Oregon that has a private contract with the state to prosecute terminations. This is going to become a bigger problem than it's ever been before if this legislation isn't passed. And the reason is that parents' lawyers have finally snapped to the fact that if they want to stop a termination, all they have to do now is file these appeals, and the termination can't go forward. This is going to be an especially big problem with Senate Bill 408 passing the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which you folks heard testimony about in a joint meeting with the Senate Judiciary Committee, because the federal government is now enforcing some pretty strict timelines on how you deal with children who are in foster care. So if I am a parent's lawyer with this decision from last spring, it makes sense for me to appeal the jurisdictional hearing. It makes sense for me to appeal every single review hearing along the line, because while those are wending their way through the appellate process, the state is unable to move to termination against my client. So, and that has not been a problem before last spring when this decision came down. So appealing, if the law is not changed, appealing will put a child into a foster care deep freeze for quite a long time, up to 2 years before a termination could be heard. To clarify an earlier point, when it's said that a child remains in foster care pending the termination, most of the time that foster care is going to be the adoptive home. The child is not in a temporary place and then we're going to move the child to their adoptive home once it's all settled. In fact, legal risk placement takes place for adoptions while appeals are pending very frequently. So a child is not on a shelf waiting.
Okay.
Chair Shetterly and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Kathy Ledesma. I'm the Program Manager for Permanency and Adoption Services at the State Office for Services to Children and Family, and I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 387. As you've already discussed today, the bill would allow the juvenile court to proceed with the adjudication of a petition seeking termination of parental rights of a parent of a child who's subject to a dispositional order entered per ORS 419B449. Or ORS 419B325, or a dispositional order entered per ORS 419B449 or 476, even though the order granting original jurisdiction over the child in the juvenile court is being appealed. SCF is the petitioner in 95% of all termination of parental rights cases, and this bill would allow us, when it's in the best interest of the child to do so, to move more quickly toward termination litigation without having to wait many months for jurisdictional appeals to be decided. Jurisdictional appeals are not fast-tracked in the Court of Appeals as are termination or TPR appeals, so it could take a year or more to resolve an appeal. Presently, no TPR proceeding can be litigated if there's a jurisdictional appeal. We believe, as Mr. Travis has stated, that there is a trend to increasing numbers of jurisdictional appeals because parents and defense attorneys know this is a way for them to buy time for the parents and prevent SCF from filing for TPR, and we clearly see this is not in the best interest of children. Buying time for parents, sometimes a year or more, means that those children will remain in foster care, even though it may be the adoptive home later on, it's foster care status while they're there. And so that really is described as a limbo for the period of time while we're waiting for this to happen. Moving these cases more quickly means we can achieve permanency for such children much more quickly. We support passage of 387 because we believe that the bill is in the best interest of children who are unable to live safely with their parents and for whom termination of parental rights and adoption is the best alternate permanency plan.
Okay. Any more discussion? I think we've had a lot of questions about the bill already, but yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wouldn't another approach to this issue being requiring some kind of an expedited appeal?
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, the court has already a lot of kinds of cases that are expedited. And we are to the point now where if we expedite any more cases, everything will be expedited. Everyone wants their appeals expedited. So this way, the only appeal that we need to expedite is the termination appeal. And then, in effect, we roll the other appeals, if they're pending, into that termination case. So they're expedited if they need to be. And when I say need to be, it's because they might hold up a termination. So, in effect, this does expedite the cases.
Are termination cases expedited?
Those yes. Appeals? The termination case itself, Representative Witt, is yes.
Now, I missed the first part of the testimony here, so what I have here is a proposed amendment to Senate Bill 387. Where'd that come from?
It's a joint amendment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that amendment came out of discussions that the Department of Justice had with the juvenile law section of the bar, with the Juvenile Rights Project and with the Oregon Judicial Department, trying to address
some of the issues that Representative Witt raised. And these, all of the parties involved in that discussion feel that although this may be an imperfect answer to the issue that Representative Witt raises, that it is a step in the right direction. And
so you're advancing these amendments to the bill?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
All right. Is there any further discussion? What I'm inclined to do then is just close the public hearing. Let's get these in LC form since we've got a couple weeks to finish up on our Senate bills, and we'll have this bill back in front of the Senate when we get these amendments in LC form. Okay. Thanks very much. Close the hearing on Senate Bill 387. We'll reschedule that with amendments. All right, our next bill then for a public hearing, we'll open this on Senate Bill 230. Council?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 230 exempts from public disclosure the names and addresses submitted to the Commodity Council Board or Commission unless the public interest requires disclosure in the particular instance.
Oh, Section 501. Yeah. Right, so you can tell this one started in the Senate. Okay, we have Chuck Craig and Susan Hiller. And I'll just bring you two up, I guess, to begin with.
Another one to add to the list.
You're saying you're not going to have a public record law, or is it just going to be?
That's right.
Everything will be a balancing test.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Chuck Craig, Assistant Director of the Department of Agriculture, and with me is Susan Hiller, the manager of the Department's Commodity Commission Program. Senate Bill 230 was introduced by the department at the request of Oregon's 29 commodity commissions. Has been mentioned, the bill would provide a conditional exemption from disclosure for the names and addresses of persons that pay assessments to Oregon commodity commissions. Oregon commodity commissions are created, they're a self-help kind of organization that are created either by referendum or by direct legislation. Once a commission is established, the commission has the authority to collect assessments from all the producers of a particular commodity and to use that revenue for the purposes of marketing or research. The commission consists of boards who are public bodies who conduct the business of the commission in public meetings subject to the public records law and under the close and careful scrutiny of the Department of Agriculture. The position of the commissions is that there is very little public business associated with the individual names and addresses of the producers, and that because the producer's business address is usually their home, in the case of an agricultural producer, that forced disclosure of this information is an unreasonable invasion of privacy. Department goes along with that view. We think of these lists more as professional kinds of lists, and therefore we did introduce this legislation on behalf of the commissions. And with that, I think I'll stop and try to respond to any questions.
Ms. Hiller, do you have anything to add?
I concur.
Okay, very good. Questions from the committee? No, Representative Wells.
Did any of these commodity commissions have anything to do with sheep?
Yes, there is an Oregon Sheep Commission.
How well he knows. Okay. Thank you very much, then. Let's have Dave Nelson and Paul Raines. Why don't you both signed up. Why don't you come on up together? Good afternoon.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson, representing the Oregon Fine Fescue Commission and the Oregon Tall Fescue Commission in support of the bill. Again, for the record, those are grass seed varieties that are produced here in the state of Oregon. We support the bill. I think the negotiations have been done in the Senate, and we succumbed. We wanted an absolute exemption, and we'll support graciously the conditional exemption from the public records law.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Are the newspaper people...
Ms. Brocker is here. I think she's not...
Oh, there she is.
She's not signed up to testify. I think she's just here to... Yeah, she's just here to make sure that we don't move this into 502. I think that's basically it.
I would be disappointed because they are usually here on all of these, and it's very normally they lose on most all of them. So it's a tough place to testify.
Do I understand though this as introduced? This would have put it into 502, which is the absolute exemption.
So they've
won
a little bit.
Yeah, that's right. They've had an impact.
Mr. Chair, I might say just in conclusion that I've been administering the Tall Fescue Commission since 1980 and have consistently invited the media to our meetings, and not in one occasion have they ever shown up, so.
Mr. Raines, how about you?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Raines. I'm the manager of the Oregon Friar Commission, and the Oregon Friar Commission and the border growers in Oregon are in support of this bill, and I was here to answer any questions that might come up involved with the friars.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to put a question to Mr. Nelson about the subject matter of the commission meetings there and whether or not they were perhaps just as boring as watching grass grow.
Oh.
I'm not even going to write that one down.
Mr. Chair, for Representative Williams, in response, having sat here for the last 2.5 hours,
I beg your pardon. There goes the bill. That's right. It has been. It just seems like 2.5 hours.
It just seems like 2.5.
All right, Lori Brockner, you're here. Do you want to say anything, or just you're just okay? She's smiling. Let's close the public hearing and move into work session on Senate Bill 230A.
Chairman.
Representative Williams, thank you.
I would move Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 230A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll. Everybody's excused who's not here.
Okay. Representative Baxman?
Excused.
And
Representative
Effort
excused. Aye. Vote, Bill.
Representative Verbalow?
Yes.
Representative Walker?
Yes. He's out in the hallway.
Representative Wells?
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Yes.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Chair Shatterly?
Aye. Senate Bill 230A goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Wells has got this one. He can talk fescue. Okay, we'll close the
That's a laconic subject.
Yes. Okay, just warming up now. We have one more. Senate Bill 267. We'll go into public hearing on that. Council?
Can we just bag the public hearing?
Senate Bill, members of the committee, Senate Bill 267, exempt from public disclosure unless the public interest requires it. And for instance, records that, if disclosed, would interfere with public services. It also declares an emergency.
Don Maggiotti.
Mr. Chair, I sense a pattern this session of exempting a lot of public disclosure.
Well, I think the pattern is bills starting out in Section 501 of Chapter 192 and ending, or I'm sorry, starting out in 502 and ending up in 501. I see this as an A engrossed as well, and I expect that's what happened.
Correct.
Mr. Maggiotti, welcome.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Representative Shetterly, my name is Don Maggiotti. I'm the administrator for the Information Resource Management Division of the Department of Administrative Services and Chief Information Officer for the state. I'm submitting this testimony in support of Senate Bill 267. Currently, information related to the security and operation of telecommunications and information processing facilities and services are not exempt from disclosure under ORS 192.410 to 192.205. This has the potential of putting these facilities, systems, and the data they contain at high risk for intrusion, sabotage, espionage, vandalism, and unauthorized access to state government data files, network maps, and the rest. This amendment to ORS 192.501 is intended to prevent access via public record disclosure laws to information technology
related to the security and operation of telecommunication and information processing facilities and services. We propose this amendment as a statutory tool to fulfill our obligation to protect and secure the state's telecommunication and information processing facilities and services. This amendment does not imply any changes to ORS 192501 related to the content of specific application of data files, that is, public records exempted from disclosure under ORS 192410 to 192505 as it currently stands. Chairman and members of the committee, we thank you for your time and consideration related to these issues. The department is anxious to work with the committee in any way we can to fulfill our obligation to protect the state's telecommunication and information processing assets.
Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Mazziotti, just for my edification, could you give us an idea of some of the more critical or sensitive kinds of information that would be currently available for public access under this, as the law currently stands?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Williams, an example would be the source code contained in large-scale computer applications that run hundreds of systems and programs within state government. Disclosure of those source codes, which are the key to the operation of the systems, would permit those with malicious intent to gain access to the entire system, to change the code itself and potentially destroy all of the information as well as the software that it organizes it.
Okay. That's pretty scary.
Well, let's hope nobody's listening.
On the internet, I sent them.
On the internet.
On the internet.
I know my wife is, because she's called me.
They're hacking already.
This stuff that's kind of, get any 16-year-old, they can get involved.
Okay. Anybody here to testify in opposition? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 267 and open the work session on Senate Bill 267A, I should say.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Witt.
I move Senate Bill 267 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much. Representative Witt moves Senate Bill 267A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Chair.
Representative Wells.
I was just looking here at the Senate amendments. I couldn't, outside of the changing from, I was wondering why they had to reprint and replace the whole bill. What language was changed outside of probably the 502 to 501?
That's it. They had to reprint. It was printed with 502 in the original statute, original bill, and then the amendment had to reprint it as 501.
Well, there is.
It's a different statute.
The language seems to be, well, I guess the language is different, isn't it?
I believe that's the case.
Yeah, right. I see the different language now. The part that's in bold is the same.
The same, that's right. They're just
it's all the original statute language is changed.
Right.
Yeah, I see you.
Okay, please call the roll.
Representative Beckman?
Excused?
Aye.
Representative Urbanow?
Yes.
Representative Walker?
Aye.
Representative Wells?
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Chair Kennedy?
Aye. Senate Bill 267A goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Who'd like to carry this one? Representative Witt?
I'll be happy to,
okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. And before we adjourn, just a official notice of happy birthday to Nancy today.
Happy birthday to you.
Not on the internet.
Not on the internet.
Yeah, it violates the server's agreement.
Do we get to put her age on the record?
No, I'm sure.
Okay, quick, we'll adjourn.